of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, we get together and teach each other how all this wireless equipment works. And that's the main thing that takes place. You really want to understand radio, you got to become a ham radio operator, is one opinion that quite a few people hold. I'm one of them. One of the things we'll be discussing tonight is that I've been promising you guys for a couple of weeks some calculations as to how Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 are working, transmitting across 9 billion miles. How in the world can that signal go that far and not get lost, not get tired? That's the furthest reaching piece of hardware mankind has ever created by a long shot. I mean, it's more than three times beyond the distance of Pluto. What a piece of hardware. 1,600 pounds when it was launched, and here we are 35 years later, and the thing is still cranking. And when you see the numbers as to what it does, it amazes the hell out of me. It really pushes the edge of the art, if you know what I mean. A person signs into the technical net because he does have a question or a comment, and he does it by giving a check-in that would sound like this, WA2PJF, Vito, and yes. Name, call letters, and the word yes means you do have a question or a comment. Let me drop. You need not sign in simply because you're listening. After 31 years of the technical net, by now we believe somebody is listening. This particular repeater occupies the tri-state area of New York City, one of the five boroughs, just barely, within 500 feet. It's at the outer skirt of Queens County, Long Island. And it covers New York, southern New York State, Long Island, northern New Jersey, and western Connecticut. So within that area, in that metro New York City area, there's a lot of brain power that we try to tap into. So when a person hears a subject being discussed, please chime in and give us the benefit of your experience. Not everything you hear on the TechNet is going to be 100% accurate. That's a given. Nobody bats 1,000. Every engineer, if he's realistic, realizes that a certain percentage of what he says, no matter how sincere, no matter how hard he tries, a certain percent of what he says is going to be an error. And just like Wikipedia, people, we've got this website called www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And on that particular website, a very enthusiastic guy for the last 6.5 or 7 years, Mike Perry, KCQNJI, has been recording every hour of every one of the tech nets. We're talking about 3,000 or 4,000 hours worth.
Selecting those posted in our new chat room, Lou and White Ridge, has been gracious enough to set us up with it. I think it's a better chat room, and I have the chat web address, so grab your pencils if you're interested, and I will give you that address. It's rather a lengthy one. Let me let it drop. Getting over that tick? Okay, the address is www.chatzy, that's C-H-A-T-Z-Y, chatzy.com, /223-225-9048-5098. Repeat that number one more time. /22322590485098. That's the complete address. KC2WGB, back to you.
And if I understand correctly, all of that was under www.chatzy, chatzy.com, / and then that great big long number, 223-225-904-45098. Somebody's going to have to come up with a more compact way of sending that. So that's the chat room with reference to the TechNet. Is that approximately the message, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Wrong number. It's /22322590485098. That's complete.
Very fine, John. Good to know. And as you know, John will later on be giving us the mailbag information for those who don't yet have a ham license or don't yet have equipment that can easily get into this particular repeater. They send him a snail mail, a pigeon dropping, email, whatever. And there was a time about a month ago when John got 278 email messages all within 1 week of people who had further questions they wanted to ask. You'll also be hearing quite possibly from Paul, WS2N. As I said earlier, I've done some calculations about what Pioneer is doing, not Pioneer, what Voyager is doing. It just amazes the hell out of me. Paul will be telling us the latest launches. And we all have, also have Hal, T16BZ, who will be giving, giving us the benefit of his 45 years of experience in radio. By the way, if you do go to, let me think now. Use whatever search engine you like. Google is one of them. And you Google the word Ham Radio University and K6DPZ. You'll see the presentation that Hal made. It goes on for about 50 minutes. That he made at the Ham Radio University a week and a half ago. Was it a week ago? Yeah, a week ago. When Ham Radio University was. And he gave examples of about 10 different pieces of very popular equipment that were used by ham radio operators over the years, maybe even 15. So you'll get a chance to see what happened. For those who knew about it ahead of time, you could see the live broadcast from Briarcliff College where Ham Radio University took place. Okay. Give us now the check-ins. Anybody who does have a question or a comment for the net, give me your call letters, name, and the word yes right now. K2RIW listening. EWO, yes, I have a question. Okay, so far we got Rich into EO, and I think it was November 2, EWO. Tell me your name, sir, and do I have your call letters correct?
It's Kilo Delta 2, Echo Whiskey Oscar, JD2. EWO, and the name is Joe Juliet Oscar Echo.
We got you, Joe. Okay, so we got Rich and Joe so far. Anyone else to sign into the ticket? Give me your call letters and name right now.
And Paul with the space report.
Okay, we know we're going to be getting a space report from Paul. Alrighty, so far we've got Rich, Joe, and Paul. Anyone else? Going to sign into the TechNet with a question or a comment. Give me your call letters and name right now. Number Hotel. From way out there in Las Vegas. Okay, we've got you, Lance. Anyone else, give me your call letters and name right now.
So you could do all stuff like that. So it's pretty good. I'm going to let it drop.
my question, and if anybody has any questions on how I did it, or I could send them, just email me, use the email on the QRZ page, and I'll send them the manual. I have downloaded it into my computer, and I could just forward it via email, no problems. My question is on J-bolts. I want to build a 6-meter J-bolt. I'm going to let it drop. When designing, I'm using a design program, a J-pole calculator by DXZone, and with the spring coming up, I want to build a compact J-pole for 6 meters. Do I design the antenna for the lower part, because I know it's critical to cut the tubing, the copper piping, at various lengths and get it close. Do I cut it for the lower end of the frequency, or do I cut it for the upper end of the frequency, 50 megahertz, 54 megahertz, or 52 megahertz?
Yeah, I think I see where you're going, Joe. Almost any antenna we build, whether it be a J-pole, dipole, Yagi, whatever, you got to select which portion of the band is your favorite, and you tune up the antenna for best standing wave ratio, and or best gain, and or best front-to-back ratio, whatever you really value. Tune it to that particular region. And on most antennas, you take, for instance, an 80-meter dipole, there's really cover with low standing wave ratio, the whole Don band from 3.5 up to 4.0, and the answer, with rare exception, is no. A simple dipole at the end of the band, if you tune it to the center, at the end of the band, you're going to get a reasonably high standing wave ratio. I'm not sure of the exact number, but it might be 2.5 to 1. And many of our no-tune rigs these days, when they see anything higher than 1.5, 1.6, they either trip out, stop transmitting, transmit it at a lower power. You get some kind of a disadvantage. And by way of an antenna tuner, if this is the best of all worlds, the antenna tuner would be located right at the antenna. If your feed line is low enough in loss, you can still get 98% performance with the antenna tuner in the shack. Let me drop.
This is DPZ with a comment.
Hal recognized. I'm going to go over to Hal in a second. With the antenna tuner in the shack, you can make the antenna give you full performance across the whole Don 6-meter band. Nice thing about 6 meters, unless you're running a couple hundred feet of cable, you can achieve rather low feed line loss, and therefore the antenna tuner can be in the shack. So whether you tune it high or low almost doesn't matter if you're willing to adapt in that manner. Let's see what Hal's got to say and how he does his adaption of a J-pole to go across all of 6 meters if you wanted to. K6DPZ, K2RIW in the tech man. Wait for the
beep. And go with the Hal. K6DPZ. Well, first off, on any J-pole you're going to build via the 6 meters, 2 meters, or 440, always build it with your mathematics for the lowest frequency. That way you can always trim it and go higher. If you design it for the highest frequency, you leave yourself no space if you have to go lower to get a match. That's number one. Number two, if you want a J-pole with a broader bandwidth, use heavier diameter material. And that will give you broader bandwidth on the J-pole. And then it's a matter of just feeding the stub the proper way, depending on what piece you're using, and sliding up the stub. Because basically a J-pole is a quarter wave stub driving a half wave section. So that's my quickie answer. Let me turn it over to Dick, and you can turn it over to N2EO.
3-5, Hal. So Hal's recommendation, start low. That way the antenna's got the full length when you're doing your first tuning. And to cut it off shorter later on because you want to tune it higher is easy. To add extra length to a J-pole is more difficult. Well, if you happen to build your J-pole out of copper tubing, to tack on an extra soldered on piece of length of copper tubing with the right kind of a union device, I think is very easy. Also, if the antenna was tuned too high and you want to tune it lower, even if you built it mechanically in such a way that you can't add extra length by adding a top hat capacitor, a very simple structure that you could add to the top of the antenna, you could electronically move it down in frequency. So there's multiple approaches to this, as you see, Joe. And it's not going to explode if you cut it on the wrong frequency on the very first time you start using it. Rigs nowadays are very good at self-protecting, so there's not very much risk in here, as I see it. Rich, I wonder if you've ever had a J-pole. I wonder how you tuned yours. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine, Dick. Well, I never had a J-pole, but I have a good recommendation. A J-pole is a vertical antenna, and the low end at 50 megahertz is sideband, strictly sideband, and everything there is horizontal. Preferably at least a three-element beam on sideband. The FM stuff is at 52 megahertz. For instance, the FM calling frequency on 6 meters is 52.525, and their repeat is up to 53 megahertz. So that's where a vertical is going to be most suited for. So what Hal said is correct. You want to start tuning and you go in, but he's probably going to want a good SWR between 52 and 54 megs, because a J-pole, which is a vertical no-gain antenna, is not going to be much use at the low end of the band. Back to Nick.
Hey, Rich. That's one set of opinions. And many a person is afraid to try an antenna that is cross-polarized. You take, for instance, the 2-meter people at the low end of the band, 144.200. It's purely sideband operation. You would think that a pure vertical antenna, particularly from a mobile, would be useless there. And when, a few years ago, when I used to travel up to Utica, New York, to the Romare Development Center every single weekend, I was using a vertically polarized mag mount antenna on my automobile, speaking on the sideband frequencies, 144.200 region, and talking to people over a 200-mile path. Mr. Pillsbury, I think of his call letters, who lived in southern New Jersey, I would talk to him all the way up to Utica, New York, from southern New Jersey, mobile, on 2 meters with a vertically polarized antenna. And when I later on installed a mag mount square loop antenna, horizontally polarized, and I had both antennas on the roof of the station wagon at the same time, and I had a switch in the passenger compartment where I could flip back and forth between the two while doing mobile operations, sideband, horizontally polarized people, the performance was identical on those two antennas. So you'll have lower performance when you're cross-polarized, but it doesn't stop the operation. It's just a few dBs of detriment. So there's many a guy who, just because he's got a vertical antenna, won't try sideband for fear that he'll get no response. There's nothing to lose to give it a try. So, and could you take your J-pole and tilt it a little bit off to one side at a 45-degree angle? Let me drop it. You can tilt it at a 45-degree angle, so you're halfway between the horizontal and vertical people. My favorite Yagi on 2 meters that I used for a long period of time, which I've got to restore, was a Cushgraf 14-element 2-meter Yagi, which I set up on the tower at a 45-degree angle in polarization, halfway between the horizontal and vertical people. And I talked to both groups for many years with that particular antenna. So there's compromises. And no matter what antenna you build, no matter what boat you buy, the boat is never big enough, the airplane is never big enough, talk to Hal, and the antennas are never enough of them. You're going to be adding other antennas at a later time. So it's not as big a deal the very first choice you make, the first crack out of the barrel, if you know what I mean, Joe. Give it a try. KD2, Echo Whiskey Oscar, K2RIW. Wait for the beeps, and you got it, Joe.
Thank you, Dick. I just wanted to try and do it. Just want to get a little more into the hobby, and soldering copper pipes together is pretty simple for me. So I just wanted to give it a shot. And I know 6 meters opens up in the springtime, so I just wanted to get some built, get it up. What would be? I would assume that the ideal height would be as high as possible off the ground.
Assume that that's almost always universally true, with rare exception on HF frequencies, Joe. On VHF, UHF frequencies, there are three things to really make an antenna work well. Altitude, altitude, and altitude. A guy building a simple coat hanger wire antenna that he can hang real high on the top of the tower or in a tree, he's going to get a hell of a lot of performance compared to a guy that's using a $1,000 antenna down at ground level. 10 VHF UHF frequencies. Also glad to hear that you're building your J-pole out of copper pipe. I've seen some of those designs. They're very sturdy. And the nice thing about copper pipe is if at some later time you want to move the center frequency of the antenna lower by adding an extra copper union on top, very easy to do. And you don't even have to solder it down. You can build a copper union. You can take a piece of sliding copper tubing on top and hold it in the right position with scotch tape, if you know what I mean. Because the impedance at the tip of the antenna is so high, the exact amount of ohmic resistance between you and the telescoping piece almost doesn't matter. So you can make it a thoroughly tunable antenna so that you remove this copper tape and move it to another position when you want to go to another portion of the band that you favor. And you can have a bunch of felt tip markings on the copper tubing of the radiator telling you exact positions to move it to get the exact tuning. You can have a lot of fun with that antenna. And 6 meters, the so-called magic band, when it opens up, my goodness, guys with flea power can talk halfway and three-quarters of the way across the United States on one hop of sporadic E when that band opens. The exact number of power watts you run and how many dB of gain of the antenna is not quite as important when, let me drop it. When Mother Nature opens that band with a sporadic E cloud, the signals you hear on that band are in the vicinity of 90 decibels louder than they would be without that cloud. If your signal that you're listening to from the guy in Texas or Chicago suddenly got 90 dB louder because a sporadic E cloud moved in the right position for the next 2 hours, that favors you and him. When the signal is coming up 90 dB, whether or not your antenna has got 6 dB of gain or 12 dB of gain, whether or not you're transmitting a watt of power or 500 watts of power, and those are like, you know, 25 dB differences, almost doesn't matter. Obviously, the band opening itself really dominates. And so you're going to have a lot of fun with that. And you tend to get some very nice sporadic E openings in late May, early June on 6 meters. And when you start getting that those great pieces of DX, Joe, come back and tell us about it so that we can all start drooling, if you know what I mean. KD2EWO, good luck with that project, K2RIW and the TechNet. Nice website you got.
Thank you. And the call letters for the ham that has the manual bells and whistles on his website, on his QRZ page is 6JD, UA6JD. And, yeah, thank you so much. I've been having a lot of fun with DXing. I put up a fan dipole, a DXCC fan dipole, and I had it at 20 feet, and then I popped it all the way up to 37 feet. My first QSO out of the gate was a guy in Australia, so that was a lot of fun.
Now, run that by again. Are you saying the first QSO you had on 6 meters was Australia? Maybe I misunderstood that. I'll wait for the beeps and give us a few more words on that one, Joe. Sounds awfully good.
No, it wasn't 6 meters. It was on 20 meters. And I had the antenna at 20 feet, and I raised it to 37 feet. I have a fan dipole. It was on 20 meters. And, once I got it all secured and everything, I came back into the shack, and the first QSO I had at 37 feet was a guy in Australia.
Well done. Ain't that a wild sounding accent they've got down there, Richo?
He actually knew the Long Island Expressway, which was really funny. He goes, it's a terrible road, and we had a little reaction about it. So it was a lot of fun. It was just amazing. I think total distance was 10,514 miles, which was amazing, and I was like super excited.
Are you saying that by some magic he knew about our Long Island Expressway, the longest parking lot in the world? Is that what you guys were discussing? Had he spent some time stateside? Over to you, Joe.
Yes, he spent time in New York, and he did travel the Long Island Expressway, and he said it was a terrible road. So, yes, the Long Island Expressway is world famous, I would guess.
Yeah, Long Island Expressway is usually pretty bad, except that when Rich uses a K2UPS, they clear a lot of space around his tandem vehicle when he drives up and down that particular road. Very fine, Joe. Please come back periodically and let us know how that project is going. Thanks, Chris. That guy on the list was Lance. Kilo Foxtrot 7, Victor November Hotel from Las Vegas. Go right ahead, Lance. Wait a little bit for the beeps, and then let's start your question. K2LIW in the TechNet.
We'll start with the correct location. It's Reno, not Las Vegas. You missed it by about 450 miles. That's all right. My question was going to be for Paul about the next study coming out of Goddard would be LISA, and it would be for the trapping and detecting and trapping of gravity waves. They figure the only way to get behind the cloud of unionized gas at the beginning of the Big Bang and through to the Big Bang will be by gravity waves. How they can learn to decipher them, how what information they can get from them after they learn to trap them. So gravity waves freely flow through all the way till milliseconds from the Big Bang. Over.
Fantastic subject there, Lance. Okay. I hope, let's go over to Paul right now. Paul, are you familiar with the LISA project, which is what I believe Lance is discussing with us? In Reno. My goodness. Boy, did I miss on that one. So, Paul, he's got any information on this one? Go right now. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Paul.
Switching frequencies, Dick. What's the question? I missed it. I'm sorry.
Okay. You sound good. If I understand correctly, Lance is asking us about the LISA project where gravity waves are going to be detected. And I'm not quite sure whether or not any recent spacecraft has been launched on that subject. I know that there's also a number of pieces of ground-based equipment that NASA has been trying to set up for a number of years to detect gravity waves. To my knowledge, not a great deal of success has occurred so far, but the gravity wave of the Big Bang would certainly be a nice thing to detect, and so gravity wave detection is the main subject that Lance is asking about, Paul. Anything you can tell us along those lines would make him and me and you happy. You got it, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, that's the LI, what is it, LI? I forgot what it is. But, laser, I'm trying to think what it was. They have one set up down in Texas and another one in the state of Washington. And I guess they've been doing that for years. I've never heard any results from it. And the reason they have them so far apart, if they got results in one, they would want to confirm it in the other one. So, they don't want to have something that, you know, maybe was miscalibrated. If one goes off, they want to see the other one go up as well. In space, the only thing I really know of is, well, you have Gravity Probe V, and that's really going in, it's a polar orbit. That's the one with those fancy gyros on board, and that's detecting any gravitational twist of space itself spinning Earth. That's not really looking for a gravity wave, but I don't think they have anything set up in space to detect anything like that, Dick. You know, they'd like to do it.
Briefly.
If you think WS2.
Yeah, when you Google the word LISA, L-I-S-A, Laser Interferometry Space Antenna, Laser Interferometry Space Antenna, Google and Wikipedia has got a nice article on the subject, and I'm not sure yet, has this mission been launched? Let's see, launch date 2034 planned, or whole. It'll be a satellite of the sun. So this one's quite far in the future, the Laser Interferometry Space Antenna. And that's the one I think you're referring to, Lance, but maybe you know of another piece of hardware that's going to be launched sooner. KF7, Victor November Hotel. K2RIW. Go ahead, Lance.
I was talking about the ground-based ones. Okay, I don't know anything about that. WS1.
I'm with you on the ground-based one. Lance, go right ahead.
Roger, roger, roger. The ground-based are Legos. Legos or something like that is ground-based. It's is two channels like your anyway, it's just two. That is ground based. Goddard was put behind on LISA because of their Jack Webb telescope. And as soon as they can get that out of the way and get money into Goddard again, they're going to put up the three LISAs will be at equidistant parking in a triangle type of configuration with laser beams connecting each one to each one. They figure when a gravity wave breaks the laser beam, it will move the spacecraft out of position just a tad, and that way they'll know they have a gravity wave or whatever they can do with it that I don't know, but that's the only way they figure they can get back through to the nitrogen that hasn't been ionized back to the Big Bang, because there's a big blank period there where optics cannot go. Optics will be stopped at that point of unionized hydrogen. So what they figure they can do is try to get back there with gravity waves, if they can decipher them and if they can capture them. That's all I have to say about that. Thank you, Dick.
Yeah, very fine, Lance. You're bringing that one to my attention for the first time, and because that's a launch quite a number of years in the future, and I guess you're fairly sure that the funding for the James Webb Infrared Telescope is now dominating, and therefore LISA, those three spacecraft, are being delayed for economic reasons. Now, Paul and I are pretty strong enthusiasts of this huge James Webb Space Telescope. You Google the word James Webb and or look at NASA's website on it, and you see the full-size piece of hardware that's sitting out in front of the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. My goodness, is that one hell of a add-on, so to speak, to Hubble. And this thing is a hell of a lot bigger than Hubble, even though it's at a much lower frequency infrared. But the advantage of infrared is that it can look through dust clouds and look through the center of galaxies and look at the supermassive black holes. So you're going to get a lot of information out of James Webb. I'm a little worried that it's a $2 billion project, and it's only one of them, and it's being launched to Lagrange Point number 2, I think it is. Let me drop. That's the Lagrange Point in quasi-Earth-Sun orbit, which is behind the Earth a million miles away from the Sun. And from that location, it'll be partially shielded by the Earth Sun radiation. It's got five shields of its own, these great big, almost football-sized shields for this infrared telescope. And the telescope itself is, I forget the size of the mirror, but it's a real biggie. As soon as Paul tells us his space report, he'll correct me on the size of that one. So, and I think that's predicted for something like a 2018 launch, if I remember correctly. And that project is moving along very nicely. So, as I see it, NASA is launching some very nice pieces of hardware. We've all got to make sure we eat lots of vegetables, control our cholesterol, get enough exercise, so you live long enough to see all these things come to fruition. I want to make sure I stay healthy so I can see these projects as I see it, Lance. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Next person on our list was Into Victor Uniform Uniform. That's Frank in Bohemia. So, Frank, what would you like to talk about tonight? Into VUU, KQRIW in the TechNet. Going to give another call. Let me drop. Okay, Frank, Into Victor Uniform Uniform. Being in Bohemia, which means you're on Eastern Long Island, you'd come out best on the 147-375 machine. Ordinary 600 KC positive up. Offset and 136.5 PL. So if you're not on that frequency, 147.375, that's the way we're going to hear you the best tonight, assuming you are really in Bohemia, like at your normal home QTH, Frank. And if you can't get back to us right away, and you can only come back and reset your frequencies a little bit later, we'll pick you up at that time. Not to worry. where you've already signed in. If we don't pick you up tonight, you'll be number one on the runway the next time we get a chance to talk to you. So let me turn it back to you again now, Frank, see if you can get to us. November 2, Victor, Uniform, Uniform. K2RIW in the second hand. Yeah, I was hearing Frank earlier, and I think he was coming in on 2585, and he's going to come out better tonight on 375975, if he can reset his frequency. I think we've got down the list of everybody who signed in. Let me do a standby and make sure I haven't missed somebody. K2RIW in the second hand, listening. Okay. I'm not going to do it immediately. I'm going to turn it over to you, Hall, and ask you give us your space report. I'll tell you what I discovered about Voyager. And my goodness, if you like big numbers, if you like long distances, and if you like weak signals, and that's what we amateurs, particularly the VHF, UHF amateurs, I'm a member of the New England Weak Signal Society, and NEWS, N-E-W-S, New England Weak Signal Society. And these guys are coming up with fancy pieces of hardware to take a super weak signal on 2 meters, 432, 900 megs, 1296, 2304, 10 gigs, 24 gigs, 48 gigs, 76 gigs, 240 gigs, 243. These guys can take these super weak signals, and if you're using the right technology, if anybody asks you what's the weakest signal you can listen to, or what's the greatest range you can get out of the transmitter, there ain't no exact answer to that, as you're about to find out. But Paul, what has NASA been doing that wants us to make us stay healthy to make sure we see the results? WS2N in the space report. Oh, wait a minute now. I'm skipping over John. Hey, John, you should have caught me on this one. Go ahead with the mailbag first, John. KC2WGV. These guys that ask us these really crazy questions, have they bent your ear and your pencil again this week, Paul? And John, KC2WGV. There we go, KC2WGV. KC2WGV, K2IW, go right ahead, John.
Very good, Dick. Well, I thought it was a change in format. No problem. Yes, I'll let it drop and I'll go on with the first question. KC2WGB. Okay, I have a young ham here who's getting into CW. And he's 14 years old. And he'd like to know, back in the day when they had the railroad telegraphy system, he understands that they had a box that had an anvil and hammer that clicked. How did it distinguish the dots from dashes from one single click? So maybe you could fill them in on that. Interesting.
I'm not sure I've got an exact answer on that one, but I can tell you for a fact, I have from time to time ran a piece of electronics where when you press down the key, you heard a click. When you lifted up the key, you heard a click. And in between, there was no tone. With practice, you can hear the timbre, that's not the right word. The cadence is the right word, I guess. You listen to the cadence of those clicks, and you can figure out the dots and the dashes. You'll know that each individual dot has two individual clicks very close together. Each individual dash has two individual clicks at a greater spacing. So with practice, a person just listening to the clicks, beginning and end of each board, I guess is the word I'm looking for, whether it be a dot or a dash, each one has got a double click with a certain spacing that's characteristic, dot being short and dash being long, spacing between the two clicks. So I think it's a matter of practice. Did these guys, it'd be nice to believe that there was a very poor power supply on the railroad telegraphy system, so that during the time the solenoid was pulled in, there was a little bit of a hum sound. That would make things a little bit easier if there really was a hum sound, but I don't think so. I think they were running on battery power. I think there was no hum, and so I think it's a matter of practice. That's my belief. Now, anyone else? We've got some Morse code people who have considered as quiet an octophone. There, let me drop...
OMW with information.
Hey, OMW. Start off with your name, sir, and tell us how they did it.
president, the new president of Limark, for what that's worth. Anyway, funny you should talk about this. My grandfather, my mother's father, actually got a patent on a side-to-side telegraph key back in 1923, and I still have the prototype. It runs on anything from 2 to 6 volts, and they use them with wet cells. Each station had a wet cell, a bunch of wet cells connected together to make up for line loss between stations. And it was a closed loop. You had to keep the key closed in order to pass the complete the circuit downline. Briefly, this system was called the Continental Code, and if you looked up Continental Code on the web, it'll give you a complete list. Somewhere around here, I had a chart that I printed out. There were only downstrokes. There was no real double clicking. And the way it worked was the space between the clicks determined what character it was. I'm going to pause here. Last summer, the B&O Railroad Museum in Baltimore had a demonstration of this telegraph system with a working sounder and a key. They had it, the sounder connected to a PC that was pounding out one Southern General's message to another. And it was going quite rapidly, so it was hard to actually pick out letters. You could pick out letters, but it's so different than Morse, where you actually have a tone indicating a dash and another short tone indicating a dot. That being said, the sounder I have is in working condition. It's called Continental Code, you can find the series of letters on the web. For example, a C was dash, dash, longer space, and then another dash. Back to net.
Yeah, I was aware that there was more than one kind of Morse code. So the ordinary Morse, as I call it, and the Continental Code are very different. And so I'm getting the impression from what you're saying that the Continental Code was more adaptable to a single-click type sounder, where only on the downstroke did it make a click. And I guess there was no real click on the upstroke. I'm a little bit surprised at that. Maybe there was a carefully soundproof piece of rubber on the up-click so you didn't hear the second click. So I'm getting the impression from what you're saying, Bob, the Continental Code was more favoring the single-click type sounder with no tone. I still think, though, with practice, the ordinary Morse, international Morse, a person with practice can hear those double clicks and figure out what's being sent. That's my belief. So was there some kind of a padding on the upstroke of the sounder to make sure there was no double click? Over to you, Bob, for some corrections on all of my guesses. W2 OMW. Congratulations, President. KQRW the TechNet.
Basically, the downforce had a stronger click than the release, and it was very pronounced. The upstroke was a soft click, and quite frankly, when I listened to this demonstration in Baltimore, the up click didn't even enter into it, and I tried to duplicate it to the host. Demonstrating how the side-to-side was faster than, you know, the straight key as we know it. And even there, you adjusted the spring tension to get the most downforce on the sounder. And basically, if you picture two solenoids side by side, and then a lowercase letter T in a horizontal plane, that was attracted downward by the magnet. Excuse me. That was attracted downward by the magnets. At the end of this arm, you had a screw with a locking thumb wheel so that you could adjust how hard this thing hit the sounder. The sounder consisted of an upright piece of metal with an opening at the top that would stop the movable arm from going up too far, and it was attached to usually a piece of wood with a little hood over it. And of course,
repeater, timeout.
And you could adjust the length of the screw that hits the sounder. That would give you, you know, louder or softer sound. You could also adjust the spring tension on the arm so that you could get an easier pull or a harder pull. That would also affect the sound quality. I'm really not remembering any significant noise on the upstroke. There was a click, yes, a very minor click, but when you compare it to the actual sound made by sending a message, you learn how to tune that out. That's a mouthful. Back to net.
Ron, good information, and I thank you, Bob. The way a human brain listens to Morse code is in itself a lot of magic going on. If you spent your time being objective while you were first learning Morse code, you discover that somewhere around 7 or 8 words a minute, you no longer were thinking about dots and dashes or dits and dahs. All of a sudden, you're doing practice. This is your 10th day of practice, so to speak. Somebody is sending you Morse code, or you're listening to a tape. And all of a sudden, you realize that the ears hear a sound, the hand responds and writes down a letter, and you say to yourself, who did that? The answer is, you did it. In other words, the brain has a multi-step process by which it converted the sound to a lookup table, to figuring out how to write that letter, and the hand moved. And all of a sudden, the brain starts bypassing some of those individual steps. And so pretty soon, you hear a sound, your hand responds. It takes a little bit of mental concentration to do that, but still, kind of an automation takes place. And as you get higher and higher Morse code speed, you no longer hear individual letters, you hear individual words. And as you get really skilled, you start hearing sub-sentences and combinations of words you start hearing as a particular sound. Let me drop it. So there are ham radio operators that really become enthralled with Morse code. For instance, my co-host for a lot of years on the TechNet was K2KEY, Mel. And he loved Morse code so much that he would literally take a Morse code tape, play it through earphones as he went to sleep at night, and it helped him go to sleep. Now, another thing I've noticed happening is that I've tried from time to time listen to Morse code that is done by way of flashing lights, and I noticed that if I mentally convert the light when it's on into a mental tone, in other words, I made believe that each time the light was flashing into my eyes, I was hearing a tone. And once I made that adjustment, that mental adjustment, I could watch light, not quite as fast, but I could get Morse code out of it. When it comes to Morse code, it had a huge impact on the Civil War. It turns out that when you watch any of those PBS specials about Abraham Lincoln during his presidency, he would every single day go over to the War Department across the street and listen to what the Morse code reader was finding out as to the status of the war. He was giving orders, finding out which battles were going how well by way of the Morse code being sent to him into Washington, D.C. So it's, I'd love to know, if you happen to know, Bob, was Abraham Lincoln's Morse code reader, I'm going to call it Morse code reader, was that the Continental Code with the clicks? And by the way, one thing I was going to mention about that. Obvious by the fact that I was able to mentally see light and make it into a tone, and therefore flashing light, I could receive as reasonably good Morse code. And if you've got a sounder where the down click is loud and the up click is soft, it wouldn't take very much adjustment to mentally plug in a tone during the period of time between the loud down click and the soft up click, and therefore there'd be no ambiguity between the clicks. And so, in my opinion, you wouldn't have to be using the continental code. You could use the international code on that sounder, and with a little bit of practice, I'm pretty sure you or I, Bob, could get pretty good Morse code out of it. Bunch of opinions on my part. WB2OMW, K2LIW, the TechNet. You got it, Bob.
WB2OMW. Well, let's see if I can catch up. I was looking through a drawer for Continental Code. I found something that seems to be Continental Code. And they do it, the letters, of course, are changed. These still seem to be a long down. I could probably round up the key. It's in the next room. Connect it to a battery and give you a demonstration. But my Continental Code is even rustier than my International Morse. And L, for example, is just a long downstroke. So what you would hear would be letter, letter, click, letter, letter, that kind of thing. Abraham Lincoln, if I understand the question correctly, they were still using clickers and sounders, as we'll call it. I don't know if they had paper tape punches yet. I know that came around the time of the stock market, later on in the 1800s. But even on a train, a telegrapher could connect by a clamping device to the overhead copper wire, connect that wire to one side of the key, out the other side of the key to the sounder, from the sounder to the rail, and that actually completed the circuit.
So what I think you're describing is a kind of wiretapping. So I think you're saying that once you knew that telegraph line running parallel to the railroad tracks was carrying messages, I guess you're saying a person could tap into that between it and the rail of the railroad, complete the circuit, operate a sounder, and in theory, I guess the system was strong enough that it would take the extra load of another sounder, and still the guy at the far end would still be getting the message. Is that sort of what you're saying? It's question number one, Bob, and I'm going to try to do a little bit further research. I know that Abraham Lincoln was making a lot of use of Morse code, sending messages back and forth to his people conducting that war. And to him it was very important every day to walk across the street to the War Department to find out what the Morse code reader, I don't think it was done by paper tape, I think it was all being written out by hand, but that's how he was keeping track of what was going on during the war. Over to you, Bob, for any other comments. WB2OMW, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Well, that's exactly right. The Civil War made great use of the telegraph. Matter of fact, railroads were using it just before the Civil War to actually run trains. In effect, it would be used to announce when a train arrived at a station so that a following train or an opposing train would be able to leave another station down the line or up the line, and they would pass.